That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome back to That Money Show on FUBAR Radio. I am Gabriel, aka That Money Guy, here to quite literally make you better with your money over the next hour or so. It's a pretty simple mission, right? And one that's probably not done, spoken about, or generally anything on the topic done regularly enough. But that's fine. We've made an entire radio show where you can come, listen to it, and get better with your money. That's kind of the promise that I give you. How do we do that? Well, we're going to take you through an entire story, a bit of a journey on the show today. We always like to give you a bit of an update about what's going on in the news. What I mean by that is, most relevantly, what's going on in the news, what's actually affecting your finances. And, well, then we take a dive into some incredible guests. We've got Alia Davis, the campaign coordinator for the four-day work week, and Alistair Mann, the content creator who speaks on everything tech. So two pretty cool guests. I promise you, everything will be related to finance and money. Our promise, like I said, is to make you better with money, and we will do exactly that. Well, firstly, joining me in the studio to help me a little bit with the breakdown of what's going on in the news is Helen Morrissey, the head of retirement analysis at Hargreaves Lansdown. Helen, nice to have you in the studio. Can you hear me loud and clear?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I've got you. You're live right now, which is amazing. Thank you for joining us and helping me break down a little bit about what's going on in the news when it comes to the financial stories. This one in particular was a very interesting study, actually done by the Hargreaves Lansdown Savings and Resilience Barometer, I believe, or a Hargreaves Lansdown study, taking a look at comparing singles versus households or couples, let's say, comparing how they were in terms of financial resilience before the pandemic, so 2019, give or take, to after the pandemic, give or take. The study itself did show that couples, households seem to be doing quite a bit better. We'll have a little bit of discussion, but the numbers that make this really interesting, I suppose, for those people listening, is that pre-pandemic, households had £235 left over. Pre-pandemic, 110. Post-pandemic, 235. Compare that to single people who had 35 before the pandemic and 40 after the pandemic. And there are some other stats that we will have a little dive into, but I would love to ask you more about this study, more about, I suppose, how it was done and what that actually means on a day-to-day kind of realistic living standard for these two lifestyles of different people.
Yeah, so thank you very much for inviting me on, first of all. And basically, the Savings and Resilience Barometer, we basically crunch a lot of different official data sets around our finances with a view to giving a six-monthly overview of the nation's financial resilience. And we break that down into all kinds of areas in terms of savings, preparedness for retirement, etc. And we do that every 6 months. Now, as you say, we've kind of covered the pre-pandemic up until today, and we've seen some really interesting kind of themes in there in terms of during the pandemic, many people working from home, they couldn't really spend very much, so people's savings grew. We then kind of had the cost of living crisis, which, you know, as I say, people's costs shot up. They had to really make some really good use of those pandemic savings to kind of keep them afloat during that period of time. Now, what we've noticed is that during the cost of living crisis, people had to make some quite strong kind of savings decisions, you're really paring back their budgets to make ends meet, and that's kind of seen them through. But now that things are starting to get a little bit better, inflation is easing, that means that people now find that they've got a little bit of extra leeway in their budgets that they didn't have before. But what we have noticed is that some groups are being left behind, and single people tend to be one of those groups.
Yeah, and I feel like I've spoken about this before, and it won't come as too much of a surprise, this idea of the single person tax. You know, the idea that when you go shopping in a supermarket, if you're buying food for just one person, often you're buying quite similar items for a couple, just because of the way things are packaged up. Like, take, for example, again, driving a car. Often you'll see both a couple and single people requiring just one vehicle for a household, therefore same costs, all that kind of stuff. So this doesn't surprise me too much. I suppose the other statistics that were in terms of the percentages coming out of this study regarding emergency savings was one that really surprised me, where not only was I surprised by the difference between households and singles, but I was surprised that generally the trend is that, like you were talking about, people actually have a lot more emergency savings than they did pre-pandemic. I mean, the numbers here say we're up for households, we're up from 47% having enough emergency savings put away to 65%. For singles, we've gone up from 37 to 47%. And for couples, we've gone up from 52% to 73%. I mean, people are really taking savings seriously. And like we said, the cost of living crisis isn't over, but we're definitely not at the height of it anymore. But it looks like this has now transitioned fully from a, you know, temporary decision to a permanent lifestyle change.
It's an interesting one, because when we say enough savings, we like people to have between 3 and 6 months of essential expenditure in like an easy access account. So that's kind of how we define it. And, you know, I think you're right. You know, I think the pandemic was a real kind of sea change for people's savings habits. And in a way, we were kind of forced into it because we couldn't spend our money. There was nothing to spend it on. And so people were able to kind of build up quite a decent kind of, you know, savings pot that, you know, actually they've come to realise came in so handy. When the cost of living crisis came and kind of bit down hard on people's finances. I think as well, you know, we have had just some really challenging times, and, you know, mortgage rates, you know, are still kind of quite high. And I think people are kind of quite nervous about, you know, if they've got to remortgage in the near future, what does that mean for their budget? So I think they're still in that kind of, you know, hunkering down mentality and trying to save money where they can.
Yeah, and I know you bring up mortgages now. That's a really relevant point, because I think there will be people listening to this that are in maybe that couples or in that kind of household grouping that I've just described, and think to yourself, that doesn't really apply to me, what you're saying, because of the mortgage kind of conundrum. And it's the idea that, you know, people that have had to remortgage since that crazy spike in interest rates are, of course, finding themselves in a much worse off position than before. You know, mortgage rates went from, well, interest rates in general went from 0.25% to, at one point, looking like they were going to go above, well, for mortgages in particular, they did go above 6% on average. Obviously, interest rates are now, they've settled at that kind of 5.25. We're starting to kind of think we're at the edge of the next kind of the hilltop, and we might be looking at a way back down. But that way back down isn't returning us to 0.25, 0.5% interest rates and mortgage rates of 1, 2%. That way back down is normality of 3, 4, 5% mortgage rates. So, of course, when the statistic that I read is, 1 in 5 people that have remortgaged in the past 2 years, so kind of since the end of 2023, would describe themselves as having very poor or poor financial circumstances. Again, our studies showing, I mean, I suppose the kind of positive side of that study is that 4 out of 5 aren't in that position, I suppose. And they have managed to figure out a right way to get about this. But obviously, we are still, I suppose, scratching the surface, or not roughly getting to halfway through this period, because it's another 2, 3, 4 years of people coming off their mortgages and entering this conundrum of a much higher interest rate. So how are you looking at that in particular? And what I mean by that is the people that are really struggling, but also this large majority that are going into this and are figuring out a way to survive.
Yeah, and I think you made a really interesting point earlier about how you know, we got very used to interest rates being so low for so long. And I think people thought that that was going to be the norm forever. And they built their mortgage budgets around that. And then when we saw what was a very, very sharp correction in the market, we saw people's mortgage payments spiraling. And it's been kind of a real shock to the system. I think where we are at the moment is that we have, you know, most people in the market are on a fixed rate deal. And it's as we see more and more of these people move off the fixed rate deals that we're seeing kind of the shock happen. So obviously in the last 2 years, it's been really, really tough for a lot of mortgage holders. What we're kind of hoping is, you know, as you say, we have got interest rate cuts on the horizon. Hopefully we'll see more new mortgage rates starting to kind of make their way downwards, you know, albeit kind of quite softly. But, you know, with a bit of luck, you know, those people looking to remortgage, you know, in the next 6 months to a year will hopefully not have quite the hard time that we saw maybe 18 months ago.
Yeah. And I suppose if we kind of mix this entire study together, what we're really hoping for is this increase in savings that people have managed to put away, or, you know, make part of normality within their lifestyles. If they are about to get hit by this increase in mortgage rates, they hopefully have that kind of balancing out, so things are manageable. I mean, kind of like I said, fingers crossed from all of us that's the scenario. One other part that came out of here, away from mortgages, because a lot of people listening to this are a young audience, which means they are probably in the renting category. Is this idea that, what was I reading? Average 2 weeks of emergency funds a renter does. 2 weeks of emergency funds. That means that they don't even have enough saved away for the next month's worth of rent as an emergency if they lost their job. Again, is this a scary statistic? Is this something you're seeing change? Has this changed dramatically post and pre-pandemic? And what direction are we heading in generally for the renting community?
So I think that, you know, whenever I've looked at the barometer data, and my particular specialism is in the retirement preparedness side of things. And when we look at certain groups that are doing well when it comes to preparing for retirement, renters always come across as a group that are struggling. And as you say, it is the fact that they are kind of having to battle with, you know, high rental costs. And don't get me wrong, people with mortgages have high costs too, but they are getting an asset out of it at the end of the day. And this is the big challenge that renters face, and that they are paying this ongoing rent with nothing at the end of it. And it's certainly a really big issue that I talk about a lot in my day-to-day job, because people are either getting on the housing ladder later or not at all. And this has all kinds of implications for their retirement planning, because they have to save a lot more into their pension to cover those extra costs, but because of their high rental costs, they have very little left over at the end of the month to help them to build up those short and long-term savings.
Yeah, I know. It feels like if you're a renter these days, you're kind of stuck in a virtuous negative cycle. But listen, hopefully things are changing on the horizon. I do quickly want your opinion on another story. Now, I know you came in to discuss the financial resilience story, and I did want your opinion because there's another story that's come out recently. Pret A Manger, I know it's a very different route, are cancelling their subscription model. Are we happy, neutral, or negative on this one?
I think there's going to be a lot of people who are very, very sad about it.
I am one of those.
The free coffee.
All right. Thank you for that, Helen. We really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you.
Cheers. Well, thank you very much, Helen. Very, very useful insights. And like I said, it's always great to not just hear my voice. Anyway, coming up straight after this break, I have Alia Davis, the campaign coordinator at the 4 Day Week campaign. You want to stick around for that one.
FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me now, I have Claire Seal, who is a content creator and author.
You know, I think there's loads of shame when it comes to money and financial difficulty, but I honestly think that shame is really a symptom of the judgment that exists in society. I don't think that people are feeling ashamed for the sake of it. I think they're feeling ashamed because you can't really sort of open your phone or open a newspaper without seeing these huge judgments piled on people who've made mistakes with money. And I think it's acceptable for people to slag you off about being bad with money in a way that it might not be for like other mistakes that you might make.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Malani.
Let's bring in Tobias Elwood, former Defence Minister.
Rishi Sunak has done well to pivot us back, taken us into far calmer political waters.
Has he taken you back into calmer political waters? I mean, you're on track, according to some of the polls, to the largest wipeout in years, and, you know, may never return from it. I mean, how has he taken you back into calmer political waters?
We've just seen inflation go down to 2%. Confidence in business is returning.
But is that down to Rishi Sunak?
You've got to let me finish the question. You keep asking me a question and then throwing another question in.
Oh, I'm just curious to know, is inflation down to Rishi Sunak?
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
I have this stunning Steph Williams with me now, founder of the WeGlow app. I did turf games on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And it was horrible. It was horrible. But it was so fun. But it was like savage, right? Yeah. But I wasn't the best in the room and I hate that. And I was like, oh, God, I haven't trained like well enough for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I don't normally think I am. But then when I was there, I was like, this is so annoying because... Yeah. And then I was like... Why do I actually need to be good at this though? Yeah. Like, can I not just do it for fun?
But also, it's like when I've done like casts and stuff before, and the blokes were like, lift that heavier weight, and I'm like, no, like I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to lift the heavier weight. Like, I know what I'm capable of. I know what works for my body.
Yeah.
And I think it's just kind of, like, I know what makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you're working out to feel good, you're gonna look good.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel Nussbaum, that money guy. But I'm not the only one in the studio right now. I've got Aaliyah Davis, the campaign coordinator at the 4-Day Workweek campaign, who I am very excited because this is a really fun topic to discuss. But anyway, thank you for joining me. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I would love to discuss a 4-day work week. Can we make it 3 or 2 even? No, we'll stick with 4. We'll stick for four, with 4 for now. For people listening, could you explain maybe really high level what is a 4-day work week and why is this something that you are petitioning for?
Yeah, of course. So a 4-day working week is a working time reduction model where workers get 100% of their pay for 80% of their working time, and in return they maintain 100% of their output. It's essentially based on the premise that workers who are better rested are able to produce the same, if not more, of their output within a reduced amount of time. And essentially the reason why we're petitioning for this is because the 5-day working week system that we've been working for nearly 100 years now is frankly out of date and no longer fit for purpose. When it first came into place, our economy was vastly different to how it is now. We didn't have computers or the internet. We weren't able to complete tasks within a fraction of the time that we were able to back then. And so we've seen these changes in our economy and boosts in our productivity over the past 100 years, but workers haven't received a reduction in working time or any kind of benefit in that way as a result. We're arguing that the 4-day week can help address wider issues of lack of productivity that we're facing, as well as boosting work-life satisfaction and giving workers a happier and more fulfilled lives.
Well, I feel like you probably have a lot of the employees side of the argument. It's probably the employers who you are struggling with a little bit. I do want to ask, why 4 days? I think like there's probably so many variations of this you could have gone for. You could have gone maybe, let's say, you know, a 9 days every 2 weeks or every fortnight. You could look at making things more flexible. So people have, you know, X hours and they just have to work X hours literally throughout, you know, a 7-day period and they can pick and choose. Or the idea of, you know, compressing those hours. So maybe it's still a 4-day work week that people have on the table, but you can add 2 hours, you know, or an hour on either end of it for the rest of those 4 days and you kind of make up the time. Why is it the 4-day kind of model that you've ended up campaigning towards?
So the 4-day model essentially is just a slight reduction in the work week. The same way we went from 6 days down to 5, we went from 7 days down to 6. It's the progression of reducing our working time. I think maybe 3 days, as some people have said, would be a bit of a big jump. Models like compressed hours have been used. So they work the 5 days worth of hours in 4 days. But what happens there is workers don't get enough time to rest. They're often overstressed or face burnout much more quickly than they would working a regular 5-day week. And so you don't see the same benefits in terms of having a more rested workforce that are able to produce for an organization. A 9-day fortnight, as you mentioned, is something that is also used. That is often a nice stepping stone on its way to a 4-day week. And I think it has become a lot more popular with various companies. We like to think it is just the first step before transitioning to a four-day week. And again, as I say, you don't get the full rest that is needed in order to see the benefits.
Got it. So talking about that, obviously this whole idea of four-day work week has to be backed, like you said, by a bit of science, right? There needs to be a bit of data and proof that this is actually an ideal scenario. In fact, not just ideal, because I assume a company's not going to go, yeah, we'll switch to 4 days because it does the same results, or, you know, mildly the same. They're looking for better results. You kind of want to like wow them. So what is the science that backs this study?
So there have been several bits of research that have taken place, especially around trials that have taken place. So in 2022, we did a large UK trial. It was the first one to take place in this country. And that had support from scholars from the University of Cambridge, as well as Boston College in the USA, who essentially assess the levels of output, the job satisfaction amongst workers, the improvements to recruitment and retention for businesses, as well as productivity in terms of meeting targets. And they can compare between the sort of the productivity and satisfaction pre the trial and also post. So we do see that when you reduce working time whilst maintaining pay and reduce workload as well, which does naturally happen when you cut down to a four-day week, you can see benefits in terms of those things that I mentioned.
Okay, so we've got the study. We've got a little bit of proof. I mean, my initial kind of feedback again is surely this doesn't apply to every company, because you said it's kind of the modern working style that maybe this is more adaptive to, the idea that people are in offices, working on laptops, using computers, using a lot of software that can automate many areas of their jobs. Are you also campaigning for this to be within more manual jobs? I don't know, just off the top of my head, you know, a building site, it kind of sounds like the longer or the more days they're on site, the quicker they'll get a job done. Maybe I'm wrong. You can tell me so.
It is a common misconception that in manual work, you know, especially take the construction site, if they work longer, they will build the house quicker or the building quicker. That's actually not the case, even in construction. We know construction industry has a huge problem with overwork and burnout, leading to workplace accidents, and some of them quite severe and can result in workers being off the site for several weeks, which would then delay building. That's just one example. There are many manual jobs that people think a four-day week might not be so applicable to. That's not the case. It might be more complex in some industries, but that doesn't mean that it can't be done. And we have seen examples of a four-day week being done in construction industry, in retail, in care sector, for example. It will just take a bit more time.
Okay. Yeah, you're easing me. I mean, you probably had me already from the start of it. I was on board with a four-day work week. Let's talk a bit of like the details of what this would actually look and feel like. So we're talking reduced hours, literally, you know, 8 hours or whatever it is, removed from someone's calendar, not moved around into the other days of the week. Which day are we cutting out of the calendar? Do we have data to back which one? Because I thought it would be Friday, because that makes the most sense. But then Thursday becomes the new Friday. And then I started to think maybe it's Wednesday, because then you kind of get two weekends. You know, you get Monday, Tuesday, and you're already buzzing by Tuesday because you got the day off again. And then you're refreshed for Thursday, Friday. But then I've also got Monday in my mind because everyone hates to go back to work on a Monday. So I've basically got every day but Tuesday and Thursday cancelled out for this one. Which one are you campaigning for?
So it really does depend on the industry, on the workplace, and on the individual. I personally have a Friday off, so I get that 3-day weekend. That seems as the holy grail for a 4-day week. Some people prefer to have the Monday off and you know, work Tuesday to Friday. But as you say, you know, so for some organisations, it might be easier to have people off on a Wednesday and work Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. It very much depends on what an organisation is delivering in terms of, do they have a customer facing role or services that they have to keep maintained over 5 days or sometimes 7-day period. And so they might want to stagger workers so that they have different days off and there's always someone to deliver the services of the company. It really does depend. And one thing we do know from trials that have taken place here in the UK and abroad is that no 2 4-day weeks are the same depending on a company. One might have Fridays off, one might stagger. One might even just have 5 days work, but reduced hours throughout those 5 days. And it really just depends.
Okay, I like it. Wednesdays it is for me, I think. I'm going to take out of all of those options. What are some of the negative sides? Because you've obviously done a study. It's definitely shown, like you said, overall a positive change, which is ultimately why you're campaigning for it in the first place. But what are some of kind of the things that people need to be wary of if they are like, yeah, I'm on board, I'm going to implement it? Because I'm assuming there are things that need to change within the actual, you know, culture, ecosystem that the business is running itself to make sure they actually take advantage of this system.
Yeah, I mean, one common misconception is that you can easily do your 5 days work in 4 days without making any changes. And that's simply not true. You do need to look at what your company is delivering in a week and if there are any efficiencies that need to be made. So one of the common things that we often say to companies who are trying to consider switching to a 4 day week is, you know, look at what meetings you have in the week. Can you cut those down? Do they need to be hour long meetings? Can they be half an hour long meetings? Do you waste time doing things over email that could just be a Slack message? And so there's a lot of times companies need to look at what efficiencies they can make in order to bring down the sort of eradicate any of the wasted working hours that won't deliver the company's aims. And so that's often a pitfall that some face. The other is not communicating with staff properly. A 4 day week can only work well if both the staff and management of a company are sort of in cohesion with it and can communicate with each other and work together in order to make it work for both parties. If you have too much of one side, so for example, if you have a top-down approach and staff aren't fully on board, it might not work. Likewise, if they trial it and the management of a company aren't necessarily in favour, you're going to have a sort of tension on both parties and it might not work. So being sure that there's proper communication and cohesion in introducing the 4 day week is vitally important.
Got it. So please do not on next week on Monday implement a 4 day work week within your company, because it like shit might hit the fan. You want to keep this stuff. It requires some planning and preparation before you do implement this. I got
planning, it. Planning, preparation and a pilot.
Yes, definitely. I noted that previously the Conservatives were quite against this concept. We are now, well, the Conservatives aren't in power. We've got Labour. Have you spoken to anyone within Parliament, and what's their outlook for this? How receptive are they towards this idea?
So it's important to note that the Conservatives' opposition was mainly to the public sector trials of a 4 day week. So South Cambridgeshire District Council, they introduced a trial, which their opposition was misplaced, we believe. Their trial has gone particularly well, and there will soon be a report looking at the benefits of the 4 day week in the public sector. But largely, they have been pro businesses trialing what works for them, and so they've not necessarily been opposed to it for private companies. In terms of the new Labour government, we haven't yet made any contact with the new ministers. We are giving them a few
weeks
grace to settle in. We will hopefully be making contact, and we'd like to. If anything, see a more positive outlook to a 4 day week or to allowing businesses and public sector organisations to trial it.
Amazing.
To see the benefits for them.
All right. Well, all I can say is if you have been listening and this does excite you, keep your eyes out. Maybe this campaign or this trial will be coming to a company near you very, very soon. Because I'm assuming there's a lot of people that are very excited by this prospect. Maybe not so many managers or business owners, but that's your job to convince them, right? Not mine, and maybe some of their employees who are listening to this show as well. Alia, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing with us a little bit about the 4 day work week.
Thank you for having me.
No worries. Cool. So, you know what time it is? It's time for Money Tip of the Week. I'd like to give you something short, something practical, something you can take away right now. Now, about 15, 20 minutes ago, I was speaking very briefly about Pret and the fact they're closing their subscription come September. I know, really sad. You used to be able to pay £30 a month and you used to get 5 drinks unlimited. No, not unlimited. 5 drinks per day. I think they had to be staggered and all of that. Well, they're ending that. Apparently, it's not worth it anymore. Their new subscription model, I believe, is £10 a month and you get half price on drinks 5 times a day, I want to say. I know, it's very sad for a lot of people. But here's my money tip. If this was actually saving you money, now I don't want to hear that you were kind of using it and you had started drinking 5 cups of coffee a day because of it. I want you to be the kind of person that was drinking 3 cups of coffee a day and now was getting them for free because of the subscription. Well, Leon, the fast kind of, I think they're kind of like a fast healthy food chain, maybe? Well, they could be the ones you want to go to now because they are offering the same, in fact, £25 a month for 5 drinks per day. I think there's also a Blank Street one, but I had a quick Google before coming on air, and there is a huge waiting list to be part of the Blank Street one. So maybe Lyon is your choice. Go save your money there. Don't go and waste it there. So if you weren't doing it before, don't do it. Anyway, stick with us. After this break, I've got Alistair Mann, content creator extraordinaire, joining me in the studio.
FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me in the studio was AJ and Curtis Pritchard.
When I used to go on Strictly, I used to think of it as like a public service. I'm entertaining somebody for 90
seconds.
And we
salute you.
And
thank you, AJ.
I want people to forget about their problems. I know it's a really weird mentality.
No, it's a... You are right in a way, right? Because there are
people
that
never made the final.
There was no need for that. Well,
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
I'm joined by fellow Love Island contestant Adam Maxted and professional wrestler, may I add. If you could wrestle any celebrity, who would it be?
I'm trying to think who would be...
Someone needs to be like your height, your size. Come on, you've got to be fair about it. It can't be like a little weasel.
Maybe like Anthony Joshua or something.
Jesus, really? You reckon you could take Anthony Joshua?
In a boxing fight, probably not.
But in a wrestling match. Yeah.
In a wrestling match, I back myself.
Okay, fair.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
TikTok sensations Jack and Sorrel. Iconically, there have been some amazing celeb couples. Who would be your favourite of all time?
David Beckham and Victoria.
Goals.
I just think, like, the twists and turns of it all, but still being together like that, that to me is peak celeb.
For me, do you know what? I just love a good power couple. We had Beyonce, Jay-Z. Like,
yes.
I want them to reign highly. I want them to be girl bossing, man bossing, just bossing throughout, and us obsessed with them separately and together.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. I am Gabriel, That Money Guy, and you are listening to us live on FUBAR Radio. Joining me straight across is the wonderful Alistair Mann, social media extraordinaire, I said before, specifically in the tech niche. This guy knows everything about industry-leading tech. I mean, we're not just talking like the classic tech that you have in your hand. We're talking about things that you probably don't even know exist in this world right now. And yeah, he sat right opposite me. Welcome to the studio. How are you doing?
Dude, I'm doing good. So happy to finally be here.
Did I give you the right intro? I said tech extraordinaire. You're elementary on mainly YouTube, but growing on Instagram, TikTok,
yeah, that's right.
All of the short form social. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Mainly YouTube. And we cover everything emerging tech. So not the stuff on your phone, the stuff that's new and exciting. AI, VR.
Emerging startups. Tech. There emerging. We go. So he's not doing iPhone reviews, everyone. Relax. He's not the new MKBHD. He's paving his own path within the social media world. And we will find the links between tech and money. Don't you worry. But first, how do you get into emerging tech as a creator? Because I feel like the easy thing, the classic creator thing is, you know, like phone reviews, gadget reviews, I don't know, microphone reviews. But you're not doing that. You're doing something very different. And I want to know how you got there.
No, it's because I've always thought like most tech content on YouTube and social media is actually kind of boring. Everyone has a smartphone now. So why are we so obsessed with how many cameras it has, how long the battery lasts?
Mine's got three.
Mine's got three too, I guess. I mean, it's one, two, or three usually. But my background's in engineering and data science. I worked in tech before. I started a YouTube channel while I was working in tech. And I was just interested in the future.
And apparently a lot of other people are also interested in the future because you've built yourself quite the following. So much so that, am I right saying you've left your job now? You are no longer working in engineering, but I mean, you're probably still very close to that world because of the amount of work you do and the amount of companies you interact with. Is that right?
Yeah. So I left my job maybe 1.5 years ago. And yeah, it was kind of rough in the beginning, but yeah, things are good now.
Yeah, I remember walking, sleeping in the street. You were struggling.
All of that.
All that kind of stuff. Nah, Alistair, he's very humble. He's been doing very well this entire time. And I actually remember connecting with you way back in the day when you were considering leaving your job. And I think at the end of that chat, you were like, nah, not leaving my job. Clearly, I did not convince you. But maybe I left a little something in there. So why social media in the first place? Loads of people are interested in tech. Not many people make videos, and even fewer people make videos that get tens of millions of views pretty much every single time. So yeah, why are you doing it? Are you just a nerd like me?
Definitely nerd is a huge component of it, but the reasons why I did it in the beginning are different to now. In the beginning, I wanted to do something on the side of the job where I didn't feel as stimulated. It seemed like social media was easy. Like, you get to see all these people blowing up on TikTok. All you have to do is post one video a day. How hard could it be? But it turns out it was really, really hard. But I kept on going. I made like a video every day for 200 to 300 days. Nobody watched. And when it started actually working, when I started understanding content, the reason for making content changed. It became, I thought I was making a difference in the world, an impact that was bigger than myself, because I could reach millions of people with a message. Then as time evolves and the content evolves, then the content became a business. And now it's just about creating a successful business mostly.
Sweet. Did you hear that? 200 to 300 pieces of content without anything happening first. That's probably the most important part of that message. So I want to ask you, you've worked with some pretty cool companies because obviously I follow your channel. What's the coolest collaboration you've ever done? Maybe even one that's in the pipeline. I don't know if you're allowed to share anything interesting coming up or previous historic, because I noticed you did a really cool one recently.
A really cool one recently. I don't know. The one that I am the most recent one that I thought was really cool is worked with IBM to cover their partnership with Wimbledon and how actually super like counterintuitive fact, but tennis fans in general, according to surveys, want more AI to be part of the fan experience. And I really like that because AI gets such like a negative rap. But this was a clear way. It's making the fan experience a lot better. They have more content to consume. It's more interesting content. But the collaboration I'm proudest of are always the collaborations that do really well. They get tens of millions of views to a startup that had almost no attention before. It's really cool when you can do that for people.
Ooh, who have you done that for in the past? What's the most viral product that you've ever been able to work with?
The most viral product we've ever done is augmented reality glasses. I think we have like at least 70 million views covering them, maybe in like 3 or 4 videos. Yeah, people love that stuff. It's what I bring on flights and it's how I justify never flying business because I have 3 monitors wherever I go.
I'm flying this afternoon / this evening. Any chance I can you bring them with you?
I did not bring them with me.
I literally should have asked you because that would have been pretty fun. Maybe next time I fly, I can nick
them
off
you. Maybe next time.
I'll take it.
I have extra pairs.
Yeah, fair enough. I saw the one that I was going to bring up. I did see the IBM one and that was really cool because like obviously that is a collaboration that probably they didn't even think of until you even brought them that idea. And that's really cool. But you did one where, did you 3D model yourself and basically put yourself into augmented reality?
Oh, so no, I went kind of. Synthesia is a company based in London, and they're basically the leading company in terms of research for AI avatars. And they have a studio here where they can like photograph you and create an avatar of yourself. And actually, if you watch some of the videos, some of the time, like an avatar speaking instead of me when the editor wants to put a line in that I have not said in real life and I don't want to reset up the studio and re-record.
And how realistic is it? I mean, people can't tell.
I bet you can't notice it. If you asked me to find a video now where he did it, I'd have to look through Slack to find when it came up instead of looking through the videos and noticing when it's not me.
All right. So you are showing us off some of the coolest AI tech that's coming out right now. What AI tech are you a little bit fearful of in the future? Because you did say it gets a bad rep and you're showing a lot of the good side, but you got to hold that judgment. You got to look at both sides of it. So what's the kind of stuff that you don't really want to work with? You don't think it's kind of going down the right route?
Something I'm afraid, I think almost all AI technology, like there's two sides to it. It's something positive, something negative. But the one maybe I'm fearful of the most, just because it's occupation, is everything that makes content easier to produce. There's a high likelihood that if it becomes like way too easy, there becomes like so much spam on these platforms, it'll be harder for the platforms to figure out what content's actually good. So I'm just hopeful that like YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, these companies become really good at figuring out what's original content, what's human content. Because right now all of their efforts are on labeling what is AI generated, but in the future, like 99% of content will be AI generated. You should be labeling what is human generated.
Great. I bring you onto this show to hopefully kind of maybe take it easy on me. Now you got me scared about my own career, my own future. Maybe I need to create myself my own AI avatar right now. Although I think one of me is enough. My wife would absolutely kill me if there was a second version of me in her ear the entire time. Unless, you know, it could do some of the household chores. But then it's not AI. I digress. I go on a completely different route. Let's now talk maybe about some of your favorite gadgets, some of the favorite things within a household. Because I know you don't like talking about the typical things. Mm. So what are some of the less typical things that you've brought into your lifestyle recently that some other people might be able to benefit from? And I'd love to know maybe even like some cost-saving things that save you time, save you money. Might have been a bulk purchase up front. This is my classic one. But in the long term, it was the right move.
Okay. Well, first, like just to elaborate on the AR glasses. Because of this, I think it's impossible to ever justify flying business. If you ever feel tempted to fly business, you can't justify it anymore. Where when you sit in economy, you can have three screens in front of you. Like, your time is not that valuable that switching to a business class seat is ever going to be worth it. That's the first thing.
I hit cha-ching, money saved, like money it, there saved. We go.
You always skip business class Done. Now. Even though like the business making enough money
gotta to
do it.
Got to cancel all of my business class flights now.
Yeah, whenever I see somebody fly business. Okay, that's the first one. The second one that was, it's not directly related to money, but like health and then money. Maybe it saves you some like fitness classes, but a VR headset. I was so not into cardio before, but buying a VR headset and playing like these boxing games means I work out and actually do cardio now. It's basically my main way to do cardio. And, you know, sometimes you go to classes like in person, you pay maybe like £50 a class, something like really expensive so that you feel more motivated. But actually you can get the same or if not more motivation by playing a game in VR from your home. That'd be number two.
And there's definitely money saved there. I mean, what's it called? Not reactive, proactive kind of, you know, thinking on this idea is like, oh, how's that actually going to save you money? Well, if you're in shape and you're healthy, there's probably a lot of money saved from, you know, potential hospital bills, you know, health things, lifestyle changes you're going to have to do down the line. So I'm going cha-ching number two. You would have had a big like cross X come up over your face right now if they weren't money saving hacks. But I agree with both of you. I do want to talk about phones because, and we will get into money in a second, and I'm going to dive in and ask you how much money you've got in your pocket. Okay. I'm not going to ask you that. But in terms of phones, maybe the phone aspect of the reviews of that don't interest you so much, but more in terms of what you can now do on the phone itself, some cool tools, some apps, some things going on there. Is there something that you've got on your phone that most people don't that is a massive help as well?
So the one app that I don't see enough people using is, it's kind of ridiculous that you can buy ChatGPT for $20 a month. Like this, it's insane how you have this huge, huge model at your fingertips. You can chat naturally through voice to it, and it can solve all your problems. Like, I use it from everything.
Well,
not
all your problems. I've got a few problems ChatGPT can't
okay,
solve.
Okay, it can solve so many problems. Like, literally everything from, like, if it's like business related, like doing like contracts and stuff, when it's simple, you can do that through voice. Or the other day, I was at a museum. I didn't want to buy one of those like pay $20 for like those like walking like MP3 audio tours.
Got it.
What was so much cooler was just like switching ChatGPT on, going on voice, and just asking it questions as I was walking around. I could ask follow up questions instead of just like listening to some pre canned track.
Okay.
You can use it for so many things.
No, I like this because I don't have ChatGPT on my phone. I probably should. Like, what are the day to day? What are you using it for? And like, how are you justifying the price? Not that it's that expensive, but some people say, you know, 20 quid a month, 240 quid a year, that's a lot of money. Justify it to them. Convince them.
Okay.
If
it saves you 1 hour a month, it's already worth it. And there's so many ways it can save you 1 hour. It could be structuring your thoughts if you're, I don't know, doing something creative. It could be like, you know, writing emails. It could be writing contracts. There's anything with text or requires you pulling like knowledge and research from the internet, I bet you can find a way to save at least an hour a month. And actually, it's not just you'll be saving an hour, but like that hour, like you're just more productive. You learn so many things that you wouldn't have learned before if you were just Googling.
Okay, there we go. 1 hour a month and it will save you money.
Oh, actually, and I have one. This is very money related. Now
you're talking about language.
I used to use two different credit cards when it came to like paying for things. One was like the very basic Amex. And the other was a Monzo Flex card. Through ChatGPT, asking ChatGPT to do the maths, I realized it is much more worth it to spend everything on the Monzo Flex card. And from the delayed payments, I accrue like 4.something% interest. That is more return than the cashback I get on Amex. And it is more cash available.
Ooh, so you've literally done the math by just asking ChatGPT to do it for you, because they know the products, right? They can look at all the data and all that kind of stuff.
They know their products, but you can just even do it by voice. Say like, oh, I get 0.65% on my Amex. I get 4.5% interest on Monzo, and it delays my payments by 1, 2, and 3 months equally. Can you do all the maths? And it does all the, it writes the code, executes the code, and does the maths. And now I spend everything on my Monzo knowing it's actually more return, more cashback, basically.
I love this. I mean, I'm a nerd right now. You've probably confused a lot of people, but I'm sure there's a few out there that are going, like, literally writing notes right now, being like, how do you download ChatGPT? Anyway, okay, I want to talk a bit about you and your relationship with money, because obviously you left your job. Engineering is a well-paid career, and it can become a really lucrative career, but it's one of those you have to stick at, right? You have to build, you know, your entire way through. So deciding to kind of cut that short, obviously you can always return, but to put it on pause for now is a really big decision. Was financials a big element of that decision to make sure that you were kind of in a good position before you could take the leap?
Yeah, 100%. I think I had like around 6 to 12 months of personal savings for myself as well as for the business before I actually left my job. The 6 months on a lower end is if I was a bit more aggressive and risk-taking with the business. 12 months would be if I was like very, very frugal.
And it's been how long since you left your job now?
Almost a year and a half.
Okay, so let's talk about it. You don't have to go into too much detail, but financially, was it the right decision leaving your job?
100%. But here's the thing. 6 months into leaving the job, it wasn't obvious. I lost money for the first 6 months straight. Like every month net was net negative. And it was only in the last year I actually started making money.
So for those people that are ready to quit their job, what's kind of your advice to them before taking that leap? Is it just having that cash, that reservation of funds? Is it making sure you're already bringing in income so you think you're going to be net positive? Is there something that you wish you'd done differently before you left?
So I think definitely having that cash reserve is like almost like it's pretty much essential. We did have some income coming in, but when you're starting a business, like you want to make room so that you can actually invest in things that could return you more money than you'd spent. For us, it was like hiring more people. So I definitely do that. The other thing was when I left my job, I had a few hypotheses for like different ways I could make money from content. And I just knew like I could go through all these hypotheses within 6 months. And from those 6 months, figure out what will be the most worthwhile and just double down on what was the most worthwhile. For us, that was doing the outreach to brands, becoming like a proper sales business.
Yeah, I love that. It's this idea that being aware that it's okay to lose money for 6 months because you're using it as a testing period and you're so confident you're going to come out the other side and you can turn something on and be like, that's the method we're going to use. And it's clearly worked. I do know, obviously, we speak offline, we know each other well, that you are using a slightly different method to most content creators. So when do people do hear kind of content creators making money? They think, you know, they've got a manager, a brand deal comes in, they do the brand deal, voila, you know, get paid. And it can be quite lucrative. But I can actually tell you that for 99% of content creators, they're not making anywhere near as much as you actually believe because it's a competitive industry. You're doing things different. Are you happy to kind of share this model, maybe inspire a few content creators that
are listening 100%.
To this?
I think, yeah, this could apply to content creators, but also people just in creative industries. Like, do not outsource your business to someone else. The business part of your business, you should be doing it in-house as much as possible. I think it's kind of ridiculous, especially if you scale. If you get to the size where, like, the price agencies charge, like, 20%, that's more than full-time salary. You should have a full-time person working on your business instead of outsourcing it. So what we do is, like, we reach out to companies now instead of waiting for them to contact us. And this means most creators, like, they cannot predict how much cash is coming in the next 1 to 3 months. We can predict how much cash is coming in for the next 3 to 6 months or maybe even longer, because we know if we reach out to X amount of people, Y amount of people respond, Z amount of people convert into deals. That's one thing. The other thing is a lot of like traditional companies, like when they reach out to agencies to work with creators, they're so used to paying you on net 30 or net 60 terms, which means you agree on a deal, you do all the work, you publish your video, and you still have to wait 30 to 60 days to get paid. I think this is ridiculous. This happens in other industries too. Now we get all of our money up front. We get cash up front. The cash flow for the business is so much better. And cash flow is like king in a business. And cash a lot of creators don't realize this, like how important cash flow is. So you can actually hire and pay people and stuff. Yeah. And the last thing we do now is that when we're reaching out to companies, a lot of them might have not worked with creators before. So we do actually have to do a lot of convincing, like to take a chance on us. But we're also able to negotiate like much longer term deals. Like when a company reaches out to you as a creator, they probably reach out to 10 or 100 other creators and you're comparing you against them. But when you reach out to a company that hasn't worked with creators much before, they're only comparing you to yourself and seeing, are you actually worth the spend? Do they think they're going to get a return on your money? You can ask for so much more and you can ask for a long-term deal. So yeah, if you ditch the agency, like
you're scaring a lot of agents that might be listening to this being like, that's our business down the drain.
I can give you like hard numbers for why it was actually such a good idea. Like I found out, I went to a brand like activation thing like a month ago, went to like a smartphone launch thing. I found out through another creator, they got paid $25,000 to make one short form video. The company that reached out to them reached out to me too a few months ago, but my talent manager never replied to them. So they left like tens of thousands of dollars potentially on the table. And yeah, for us, you know, in the beginning, it was hard. Like doing all this outreach is a lot of work. It does cost money to send a lot of emails. But yeah, like over the last 12 months, like steadily, we've been increasing to now in the last month, we've done $100,000 cash in compared to losing money 1 year ago.
In the last month.
Last 30 days, just over 100K.
Wow. If you needed any more convincing, there it is. Alistair, I want to ask you one last question very quickly. It is a money show. We do like to talk about personal finance. From a personal perspective, what's one financial tip you'd give a younger version of yourself?
Younger version of myself.
Could be last week if it was that bad.
Okay, the very first time I got into investing and buying stocks and stuff, I got very afraid when stocks went down and I would just sell. Because I would think like stocks just go up, you just like your money compounds. And if I just held on to my stocks like a few more weeks or a few more months, it would have been net green. Just don't be afraid the first time you invest. If you see the numbers go down for a while, overall it usually goes up.
It's part of the journey. Investing tends to be for the long term, so don't worry about the short term. I like it. Alistair, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming in. I'm sure we'll catch up again soon.
Yeah, I'll see you soon. Thanks for having me.
See ya. Amazing. There you go. I mean, Alistair was talking some serious numbers there. Very, very intriguing as a content creator, and definitely one that's thinking way, way further ahead than the majority of content creators out there. So even if you're not into content creation, hopefully that chat inspired you and interested you in some way, whether it was the AI, the financial side of a content creator, or the little bit of investing tip at the end. We do like to do scam of the week, and this week, I was actually on my socials talking about what I actually believe to be one of the biggest scams out there. And it was Amazon Prime Day. I know. Honestly, a lot of people genuinely are like, what? Amazon Prime Day a scam? What are you talking about? What most people don't realize is that majority of sales that you're seeing during Amazon Prime Day aren't actually at their cheapest point at that sale. A lot of them, firstly, just cross out a price and have them at a regular price that is kind of at that price for 90% of the year anyway, so it's not even a sale. But a lot of the sales are actually better at other times of the year, and I think that this is something that most people haven't quite figured out. They see Prime Day, they see it's happening over 2 days, and they think they just have to buy something really quickly. I kind of identify that a little bit as a scam because, you know, they're kind of tricking you and putting pressure on you into buying something financially. So instead, what you like to do is there's a few different ones, but I like to either copy and paste the like website link of the thing you're going to buy on Amazon into a website called camelcamelcamel.com and look at the price history, and quite literally it'll tell you there and then, are you actually getting the cheapest price possible, or does it often go to an even cheaper price? And that's one way to look at it. So yeah, that's one tip. And number two is, with any sale, with every sale, if you were not going to buy it and you were only buying it because you found it something at a good price, you are wasting all of your money. If you're going to buy something and you've kept your eye on it for a while and all of a sudden it's dropped to half price, that is where sales are useful. So please do not go scrolling on Amazon Prime being like, oh, what should I buy? That is basically how sales get you. Anyway, that's scam of the week. Sorry if anyone from Amazon is listening. I do love you, and I did actually buy some stuff on Prime Day. I just made sure that it was actually a good deal. We now always like to end every single show answering a few of your questions. So If you do want to be on next week or one of the upcoming shows where we answer one of your questions, just DM us on at That Money Show on Instagram. That's at That Money Show. But we've obviously got some questions in that we did promise we were going to answer as well. We'll start with Lydia, who says, I'm traveling for a month and I don't know what to do about money as I don't want to get charged high rates for using my card abroad. Any advice? I love this one, Lydia. I did a lot of research. There's a few different things you can do. Number one is there's loads of kind of debit cards that offer basically zero transaction rates, is that right? Zero fees for spending abroad. They'll basically give you the best conversion rate possible. A few of those that come to mind are Monzo and Revolut. The free cards even do this. They even let you withdraw a certain amount every single month. I think it's around £200. So that will cover you with enough cash. And also for card, using your card as well. If you want to kind of go up a level, there are a few credit cards. I currently use the Barclaycard Rewards card. Again, not only does it have zero fees for spending on a card abroad, not only does it give me basically as good of a conversion rate as possible, but it also gives me 0.25% cash back. So I get paid for going on holiday. So yeah, there's plenty of cards out there. Just do a bit of research, a bit of Googling, and you can figure it out straight away. Next, we've got Jake, who has asked, I'm due to be getting a raise that would take me above the £25,000 threshold that would mean I would start to pay back my tuition loan. If I were to increase my pension contributions, what would that mean? I wouldn't have to start paying it back. Yes, you can. As long as your pension contributions are salary sacrifice, which means they kind of come out of your pre-tax salary, so your company take it out and then pay you the rest, this can lower your salary and result in you paying less student loan. If in fact zero student loan if you go back below the threshold. So this is absolutely a way. This is often a way that people pay less tax. They get moved into lower tax thresholds because you contribute your pension and then you get taxed on everything after you've contributed your pension. So yeah, the answer is very much so you can do that. Unless you are on, I think it's called a relief at source, then that's coming out of your post. So you've already been taxed on your income and then you're putting that back into a pension, then it wouldn't work. It has to come as salary sacrifice. And then we have one other question. So Rob wants to know, what are your thoughts on buy now, pay later companies like Klarna? I always use it when purchasing items like clothing, but I don't know if it's a good idea. Yeah, this is a bit of a tricky one. When it comes to kind of buy now, pay later, which a lot of companies are using these days, my general feeling is it's not a great idea. They are generally put in place to incentivize people to spend money that they don't have. So it's just a scheme, basically, to make you think you can afford something because you're, you know, spreading the payments out over a few months. I would much prefer you to do it the other way, where you save the money over a few months to make that purchase rather than spend the money over a few months and have to save less and kind of pay it back every so often. Ultimately, it's a debt. You're adding a debt to your lifestyle. Not great. I know a lot of them also come with 0% interest rates. So it's kind of another one which is a bit of an incentive. Some of them even have zero late payment charges. So I can understand the kind of pull towards it. My kind of whole policy with kind of borrowing money to buy things that you want is that it's generally not a good idea. Now, credit cards are slightly different. And the reason why people use credit cards is because there's an actual benefit to using the credit card in terms of you're going to get some kind of cash back, some kind of reward, and you pay it off in full every single month. So that kind of debt never lasts more than the month. You pay it off as a statement. And that's why I kind of do work with kind of credit cards. And I do believe that they are can be a great source for people that know how to pay them off in full. With buy now, pay later, companies like Klarna, yes, I understand how they can make sense. Maybe you've had a difference in kind of your cash flow, maybe your salary. So there are going to be certain circumstances where they do fall into favor. But overall, my advice is if you're needing to really rely on BNPL, something like Klarna, to purchase something, you probably need to think twice about what you're actually buying, especially if there are things like fees and the risk that you will accrue huge amounts of interest if you miss a payment, late payment, or even you may have to pay interest regardless of whether you're paying on time or not. Those are the kind of things where I see red flags. So yeah, my general advice is I'd rather you didn't, save up and afford it And yeah, not my favorite method of borrowing cash, unfortunately. Sorry to those of you that do use it. Anyway, that's all we've got time for today. An entire hour just flew by. How quick was that? What an incredible show. I mean, we discussed things like financial resilience compared to households and single people. We took a look at the Pret deal that's being cancelled. I know. It's a sad day. I wish I could play like a little violin on the show. We also had Alistair Mann here, the content creator extraordinaire. I've used that so many times now, and he's going to absolutely love that I said that. And also Alia Davis, the campaign coordinator at the 4-day work week, which I would like to implement. I think they should start looking at 3- and 2-day work weeks. You can always listen back to the show, by the way, guys. You can find us at That Money Show on all good podcasts, on all good podcasting platforms. You can listen to us live by downloading the FUBAR app, and you can find us on socials at That Money Show. I've been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show. You are now officially better with your money than you were an hour ago. And thanks for listening.